Season's greetings, everyone. Kevin Woodside here for another installment of the North Kent Heritage Society's official podcast, A Place in Time. This episode today is a little self-indulgent. I invited my dad and his three brothers to have a chat about growing up in North Kent. Obviously, with this episode being produced in December 2020, things are a little different this holiday season. Family gatherings are limited or canceled altogether, so moments of nostalgic reflection are few and far between. But, you know, one thing I always enjoyed about family gatherings was to hear my uncles and grandparents share these stories of their youth and growing up in the same community I did, but in a very different time period. Thanks to Zoom, who's not a sponsor, I'm just giving them a shout out, I was able to gather these brothers up for a roundtable chat about growing up on 7th Street and in a North Canton that is similar to ours today, but also vastly different. Now, what you'll be hearing today is only part of the conversation. The rest will be released next year as part of a special mini-series. More information about that at the end of the episode. All right, so without further ado, here they are.
I'm Blair Woodside. I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and I'm 75, just a few days away from 76.
Whoa. I'm Bruce Woodside. I live in Paonia, Colorado, and I am 71, just, I guess, some additional days away from 72.
I'm Brian Woodside. I live in Copley, Ohio, and I'm a long way away from 70.
I'm Brent Woodside. I stuck around in North Canton, and I'm even farther away because I'm the youngest.
All right, so I'd sent out prompts, but it's the holiday season, and I wanted to talk about some Woodside Christmas traditions before we get into some broader topics. So tell me about Christmas in the Woodside family of old.
In our family, Christmas was a big deal. Look forward to it with anticipation. We always had a tree in the front window and everything. But it was family oriented, as I remember it, and trips to the grandparents' house in Canton, Ohio were part of the day. But it was very family oriented, the holiday season.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, I remember going to the community sings and stuff, but it wasn't a big deal for me. For me, it was like making the food, the candy, the cookies, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I knew it was Christmas because we went down to Martin Luther Church in Canton, and man, did they decorate that church for Christmas.
Yeah.
Christmas and Easter. So I remember it was just really special because oftentimes you would be, I don't know, it seemed like we went to Christmas Eve services there and it was dark and all the lights and the trees in the church and stuff like that. That's what I remember about that sort of public aspect of Christmas. But for us personally, it was the countdown to Christmas and presents and cookies and Christmas cake and especially the candy making operation, which Brian knows something about.
Would you mind talking a little bit more about the candy making operations?
I was in the candy eating operation.
Yeah, it was originally a Garthwaite tradition that Mom and Dad took over, and I remember Dad setting up a table in the garage, and because it has to be below about 45 degrees in order to be able to make it work. You heat up a big pot of sugar and water and a little bit of gelatin, basically, and you get that to a certain temperature where it's forming a ball of liquid as it comes off a spoon. And then you pour that onto a marble slab that has cooled down with bars around it to hold it in place. And then you wait for all the heat to go out of it, and then you take the bars off and you put egg whites and vanilla into the middle of it. You take a big spatula and you work it around. And I particularly remember Dad having his bottle of Carling Black Label beer that he would sip while he worked it, and when the beer was gone, it was supposedly done. Then you would roll it into little balls and coat it in chocolate and wrap it in wax paper wrappers and put it in bags. So, which some of that we did, and a lot of it Mom and Dad did.
Yeah, I don't remember doing much of that. What I remember is the cookie making and decorating. That was the part that we really took part in. And that was always a lot of fun.
You must have got off easy with the cookies then, because I remember wrapping the candy a lot.
Yeah.
And wow. dipping and wrapping. Yeah,
that late Sunday night, usually late on a Sunday night, because we had to take gifts of the candy to school for our teachers and so forth. So
yeah, you're right. It's coming back. I remember that.
It had to be done on that weekend, and it was an all weekend affair.
Mm-hmm. And they boxed it up they gave it to teachers and neighbors and friends. And I remember taking boxes to people, but I also remember the cookie making too, because we did a lot of cutouts, but we also did cookie press cookies.
And there was always the blob at the end.
Yes, the blob.
Amalgamation of what was left. And then you just covered it with every icing you could.
They made peanut brittle too, didn't they?
Yeah, yes. I have Mom's peanut brittle recipe too. I've only done it once. And they made Orientals and buttercreams and opera fudge. Those are the candies they made.
It was always amazing to me that the things that they did. Dad worked. They made the candy, they did the cookies, they got the Christmas cards out. They
hundreds of Christmas cards. I mean, yes. There was a box full of addresses, and whether they had cards had little checks on them as to whether they had sent out a card and received a card every year. That was Mom's duty.
She would have her card table set up and a card file there and go through all of them. But they did all of this. And then when we were real young, and I don't know if this continued forever, I don't think it did as we got older, but when we were real young, they would put up the tree on Christmas Eve. So when we went to bed on Christmas Eve, nothing would be there. And when we got up in the morning, the tree was up and all the presents were under. And somehow they did all of this and got us to church on Christmas Eve, and we delivered papers in the morning.
And Christmas was the money-making season, because you could go out and people would give you basically your tip for the year when you collected for the paper.
And I think at Christmas time we had to deliver on Christmas Eve, right?
Yep.
And I think it was after the Christmas Eve service. Because I remember walking when the snow was falling one night, and snow was falling, and it was actually really beautiful. It was like a beautiful Christmas Eve night, and people had left envelopes in the door with, you know, your little bonus and everything, Christmas gift. It was nice. I actually enjoyed it, which I didn't most of the rest of the time.
It was late at night. It was like 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. But the parents were still up, usually putting out gifts and decorating trees and stuff. There was something kind of magical about being able to run around and deliver the papers on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I agree. It was.
Well, you never really got out of the paper route for a while, because as soon as you handed it off to the next one, why, your job was to drive the car on Sunday mornings and with the heavy papers and so forth. So it would pass from one to the other of us, but then the older one had to do the driving instead of Dad. So
that didn't happen in my time. I mean, I passed it to Bruce. I guess I didn't pass it to Bruce. I sort of had Bruce as my slave for a while.
You inducted me, yes. Yeah, right. It was a draft. It was still not making a choice.
Still making money off the paper out myself, and then finally turning it over to him. And I think I had it for 3 years. I was the one who went out and took the initiative to get it from the guy who lived in the big white house up there on Portage.
Bill Sanis.
Yeah. I went up and I just asked him, I said, you ever going to give up this paper route? He said, in fact, I'm thinking about giving it up in the next month or two. And I went around with him for a couple weeks and helped him. And he turned the paper out over to me.
I used to help him deliver papers. I would ride on the bar of his bike and he would throw the paper. And if it missed the porch, he would stop and I would run up and put it on the porch. And he gave me a 50-cent piece for it. Yeah.
do you ever practice folding the paper and throwing it now?
I have.
I have a few on the roof from time to time, especially well, over Worcester Street. I found
the most challenging thing was the big ones on Sunday, putting them inside the door, where you had to start them about halfway up the door, open the screen door, start about halfway up the door, and slam it before it hit the bottom, you know? So.
Yeah. When you'd wing it, and it would hit the door real hard, make a huge noise, and you'd go, get
out of here. Yeah, I got yelled at a couple of times for somebody during the summer when somebody was sitting that close to the door, and I banged it. I remember somebody on 6th Street, and I banged it off the door, and boy, he was up and before I could get very far, and I was moving pretty fast, too. But
yeah, I used to pick a corner and sit the papers down and fold them up in the bag, and then grab the folded ones and run up the street and down the street past the porches, dropping them at the porches. So I wasn't really throwing them very far. I was just dropping them as I went. I also recruited a lot of neighborhood friends to help me whenever I could. Kind of that
let's not forget though that you transitioned that to me and did a lot of work there too, so yeah. I was an assistant, or maybe Blair put it, a slave before I took it over completely.
Right. I was really sort of a paper route manager.
Yeah, I'd say that's fairly accurate.
taking our slice off the top and leaving you with a pittance.
And I think Scott Hill down the street took it over after me. That's who I passed to.
Mm-hmm. I remember I was getting really sick of it by my senior year. It just took up too much time, but I still wanted the money, and that's why I started getting Bruce to do a lot of it. So
it ruined my life. I mean, I should have been home on Saturday mornings watching cartoons. Clearly, I should have been watching cartoons, and I had to go out and collect for the newspaper. And I would put that off for as long as I possibly could. I would go out at noon or one.
You had to do that part because that was the money.
I know, but
collecting was the worst part of it, though. You know, asking people for the money, and even, you know, you're talking what, probably $1.50 or something, and they'd complain about not having it that week.
Yeah.
You know, catching next one. You always had, we had the changers that you hooked to the belt, the coin changers, and then we had a ring with all the cards on it, and you'd have to punch the cards, and then they had their own card, right?
So I still have my punch.
Punch their card. I like the people who paid for a month. That was always nice.
Yeah. The nicest person on the route was, I thought, was Mr. Swope, who was since we're doing the North Canton thing here, I believe he was a history teacher in the high school, but he had also been the coach that won the championship with the football team back in the 30s or something like that. His son, Bud, was in my class in high school. That was the nicest place to go.
No, there were some other good. Mrs. Burnett was on Pierce, and she was an English teacher at the high school. And she liked me, I guess, and we got along with her. And there were a few. One thing I remember, though, on Fifth Street was there were like five dachshunds on Fifth Street when I was delivering. We referred to it as Dachshund Row. So the Stevens and the Bishops and the Baxters or something like that, they all had dachshunds that would come running out at you when you were delivering.
Mrs. Baxter would talk my ear off. It was hard to get out of her house. So she was really nice to me. But
she loved you.
Was the principal of the school, wasn't he? Mr. Bishop was the 40th Street principal or something?
Well, he was. He was. That's right. I forgot about that.
Mrs. Baxter liked you because when I took over the route, she always asked how you were doing every time. Yeah, I'm fine, thanks, but let me tell you about Brian.
I remember, while we're on the topic of Mr. Bishop, I remember when I was, am I mixing this up? No, I'm pretty sure this happened at Portage Elementary, where I was climbing in a tree out by the playground. And I fell out of the tree and tore ligaments in my ankle. And everybody went inside. was trying to drag myself across the blacktop. I don't think I had gotten more than 30, 40 feet in 20 minutes, and my teacher all of a sudden comes out across the playground. She had noticed I wasn't in class, and of course, parents got called, and I was in it, all wrapped up and on crutches for 6 weeks. I got a very serious lecture from Mr. Bishop about climbing trees during recess on the playground.
I just said I wanted to hold on to that picture of you crawling across the playground.
It wasn't crawling, it was dragging. It was kind of like when a baby's learning to crawl and slap your hands out in front, drag yourself and slap your hands out in front. Stop, rest for a minute or two. That was not have a, to, I still to got a weakness in that left foot from those ligament tears. That left
To share one more Mr. Bishop story, we were always told that he had a paddling machine in his office. And one time, one year, we were like, I don't know, second or third grade, but there was this whole sort of forming gangs things. We weren't having gang fights or anything, but they named gangs and we would hang out on the playground together. And we all got in trouble because one of the gangs decided to steal hood or hood plates or something off of cars. And they called us all in two at a time. Just all the kids just to kind of check out and ask what, you know, all this. And there over in the corner of Mr. Bishop's office was a big machine covered by a big like plastic cover, dark so you couldn't see through it. And we're like, there's the paddling. We were all scared to death. You know, it was probably a mimeograph machine. Yeah. But we were all, he really does have one from that point on. Nobody got paddled though.
You were allowed to paddle in elementary.
Yeah, in those days.
They would take you out to the hall and they would paddle you.
Oh, middle school too. Mr. Nichols used to be notorious for paddling.
Yes.
Chad, I had the moment during wrestling season in high school when I fell asleep in Mrs. Arndt's class and she would collect squirt guns from students, and the wrestlers had a tendency to fall asleep if we were losing weight, and she would squirt us with the squirt guns from her desk. So I got squirted a few times.
Again, I had established a perfectly good reputation with Mrs. Arndt.
I know.
You go in.
She expected too much from me.
I liked her. She was one of the better teachers, I think.
Yeah. She was lots of fun. I was afraid of her at first because she used to do the squirt gun thing in study hall. She would just stomp around with her squirt gun and terrified me. But then I got her for English and started writing compositions, and she was really appreciative. So, and then you came along and blew it. So
all of the English teachers liked you though, Bruce. So
yeah,
that's true. Yeah. I've disappointed all of them. No.
Well, I disappointed them following you, believe me.
Oh, okay. Carrying on that tradition. We'll
share the credit.
So what was there to do in North Canton back then?
Build forts. We built forts.
Yeah, we did.
I don't know who we were protecting, but we were building forts.
Well, we kind of had a little rivalry with the Sixth Street gang at Gang. At times. But yeah, well, we were fortunate really that we were in a neighborhood at that time that it was all new then, and families with kids moved in. So there were a lot of kids there. So we did all kinds of things, played football, baseball, basketball.
Plus there was the woods. It wasn't really a woods, but it had trees.
Felt like a wood, big woods to us. It had the old oak, which we all thought was the biggest tree, tallest tree in North Canton.
And the five branch tree that was right behind the right corner of our backyard where we built all the sheds.
That was a tulip tree. It was,
Yeah.
But the woods was hickory, maple, elm, and oak, basically, with that one tulip tree sitting there.
Yeah, I can do this from the beginning because I was there when we moved from Canton to North Canton when I was in the second grade. And when we moved into that house, the Allard's house, the brick house next door, was just being built. And the two houses on the other side, there were no houses there. Those were dirt hills. Mostly the other side of 7th Street was built up, but our side was being built out. And a lot of what I did initially when I made initial friends in the neighborhood is we were playing cowboys and Indians on those hills, big mounds of dirt right next door to our house. So that was sort of everybody coming into North Canton. These new young families were arriving right in that neighborhood at that point in time. We were sort of midway through the build out. And then what happened after that is we transitioned, unlike today where kids are pretty much monitored and restricted from going too far because of the potential risk out there in the neighborhood. What I remember is being able to go to the woods, kids just running back and forth across the street all the time, being able to go to other streets as you got older. I remember we used to go down and play in the area of the stream in the woods behind the Boger's house up there, the Boger's house and the there was a cabin back in there behind that. So as you got older, up around 10, 11, 12, 13, you were allowed to really ride your bike. You could pretty much go all over town in those days, as long as they roughly knew where you were and when you were coming back. You can't do that nowadays. You certainly can't do it here in Washington, D.C. area because of the concerns that are out there today. But, you know, there was a lot of freedom to go out and create all kinds of fun for
havoc.
Yeah,
it was always just get home by the time the street lights come on.
Yeah, or when Dad was banging the dish for Rusty.
Well, yeah,
come get his food.
We're yelling your name across the entire neighborhood, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and that was something, I don't know if parents do that now. I don't think I ever did.
But Mrs. Rohr actually used to go out and do the Tarzan yell.
Yeah, you could see where Ronnie got his characteristics, that's for sure. But yeah, and parents would just come out and yell on top of their lungs for their kids to come home, you know, and you better come.
And then you'd yell, coming, and then if you didn't come, you were in big trouble. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But other than that, you were free to pretty much roam. Even when you were younger, you were free to go back in the woods or visit your friends' houses on Pierce and 7th Street, things like that, or even over to 6th Street, which was scary because the gangs were over there.
Yeah.
The gang.
That's why we built the forts.
I got to tell you, Blair, though, your description of the neighborhood makes me realize how much older than us you are.
Yeah. Well, for the forts we built by the down where the old oak was and everything, we would go up to the Hoover Company and get crates. So we would actually get a small group of us with our wagons, and we would
red pull flyers. Them. Yeah.
Yeah, and we would pull them all the way from 7th.
Two wagons completely and totally. Hauling those crates, those huge crates back. And Dad felt sorry for me, so he finally got a truck. I had like 24 of those big wooden crates that I built into a two-story with a couple of my friends, built into a two-story clubhouse behind the house. And I'm sure today somebody would say, take that eyesore down tomorrow. But that thing was there for a couple of years. Back on the corner of it was actually behind the Allard, more behind the Allard's property than
you wouldn't let me be part of it. I had to go get my own crates along with Linda Rohr, and we had our little fortlet out one side of your giant Pentagon like complex.
Yeah, I remember you wouldn't let us in it at all. So.
I don't even remember it.
That was a two-story job. That was something else.
You went in the spiders. Bottom,
and then there was a hole that you could crawl through to go up to the hallway on the second level. And, of course, each crate was its own separate room. And then there were crates on the end where there were separate rooms, too. So
I beat you, though. I had a three-story fort.
Is that right?
But near the old oak, yeah.
Do you remember that we set up defenses around it? We were digging that big ditch in front of it for the rock.
Yeah.
And we were going to put stakes in there and cover it with brushes. And Mr. Degg came out and said, what are you doing? We're setting up a trap for Roush's gang. He goes, fill that in.
That one I remember. I don't remember Blair's.
You were in that fort when I fell out of the old oak.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, because you ran after me from that fort.
Yeah. You ran screaming across the backyard, and suddenly near Allard's you stopped, and I caught up with you, and there was your, was it your left arm?
Left arm, yeah.
Dangling from.
I remember the second incident when he went out in the backyard and he played football, and I'm standing in the dining room window watching. I said, Brian's going to break that arm again. Next thing I know, he raises his arms to block a punt. Bang!
How many days was that after? How many days was that after you got the cast off?
Yeah, yeah. Dad was not sympathetic. No. Back in those days, there was no health insurance. You had to pay for that a second time.
No, and I was outside involved in the football game, and as soon as I run in the house and I hear Dad, we left the yard fast.
Wasn't it that you were holding a football for Jim McGeorge to kick?
No, I tried to block Jim McGeorge's punt, and I stuck my arm in between the ball and his foot. And
All right.
It broke, and I went running in going, I broke it again, I broke it again. Nobody was very excited about that.
Or sympathetic.
And nobody could take me to the hospital, so Grandpa Garthwaite had to take me to the hospital.
Oh.
And the doctor wasn't there, and his partner, in Canada, and his partner wouldn't come back in. So an intern put a cast on it and over 45 minutes squeezed it into place, which wasn't into place really, and then sent me home with, I was in terrible pain. And at 6 o'clock the next morning, Mom woke me up. They took me back to the hospital and Dr. Muckley was there then, and he was really upset, and he took me into, I remember getting ether and going into surgery, and they took the cast off and set the arm. And this time, the first time they put a cast on just from here to my elbow, the second time he put it all the way around up to here and said, I'm leaving that on for 6 weeks. And I remember you making me the playing card Halloween costume so that I could go out for Halloween with my arm and nobody would know it was me because my arm was inside the playing card.
I had to wear that the year after you, and I remember going to, I took, wore that to school, and I couldn't even sit down in.
Yeah, that was one problem.
Yeah, well, it had its drawbacks.
Well, we built some, kind of some forts in that tulip tree back there, too, and that's where you filmed the Tarzan movie.
A lost classic.
Yeah, and there's nothing...
No.
Nothing left. That's too bad. I think I had some sort of a starring role in that.
But. You did. But Ronnie was Tarzan, I think.
Yeah. Well, he had a great Tarzan yell.
You guys probably don't remember this, but we used to take boards out and lay them in the backyard and create a rocket ship. I don't know what space movie we were watching at that point in time, but we'd create this big rocket ship. It was about 20 feet long and 8 feet wide, and we'd lay the boards, create sections. And you guys would all sit. Of course, I'd be the commander up
of the
rocket ship. You guys would all sit in certain areas. You had certain responsibilities of the rocket ship. And we used to create these great storylines out there doing that kind of stuff.
Well, I remember when the creek was still down there that still ran like 7th over to 5th. And somebody built a raft. Was it? I was really young, I remember. I was on the shore. Was that you, Brian, and somebody else?
Yeah.
And you got, as soon as you got on it, it sank, I remember.
Yeah, I tried to plug the cracks with mud.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a brilliant idea, but it
I just remember standing on the shore very excited, and you guys were really working hard at it, get it out there, and just got on and just sank into the creek.
Remember how the back of our property used to flood, and we had a
crate. I was just going to bring that up. We used to ice skate. There was a real flooding problem in that whole backyard initially when we moved in there. Dad worked and worked to resolve that problem. There were a couple of years we had full gardens in the backyard. There was no grass initially, and it was all garden. And then in the wintertime, it would flood, and we would skate out there, and the grass would be sticking up through the ice. And of course, your skates would be cutting all the tops of the grass off. But the whole thing would flood. You could skate all across
that
the
was, back. That area. Was a Hoover right away, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that yeah, was part, back there.
Part of the backyard as well. Would.
Yeah. Yeah, it would flood. The whole area back there would flood. I don't know what he did to resolve that problem, but he must have brought in a lot of dirt or something.
I'd say some of the biggest differences, though, Kevin, were kids' ability to play all over the neighborhood and to really go all over the town at about 12 years old. And other people's parents were like your parents. They didn't have any trouble yelling at you if they thought you were out of line or, you know. You kind of went into everybody's house and out of everybody's house. The neighborhood was really a big family neighborhood with a lot of people in that age with, you know, young kids and so forth. So it was really a huge sort of communal area that everybody yelled at everybody else or took care of everybody.
You know, as I was growing older and everything, our woods slowly diminished because Faith Methodist Church bought that corner and they took out about half the woods, and then they slowly expanded. And at one point we were afraid they were going to cut down the old oak. So all us kids were going to unite and stand around the old oak. And it didn't happen until they actually cut it down many years later. But so we kind of lost the woods over, by the time I was a teenager, there wasn't much left of it.
Brian actually dug a cave into the hill.
They had a big dirt mound when they were building the church.
A cave that would have collapsed. And
do you remember when I tried to dig my way to China in the backyard? I dug that hole that was over my head. Dad finally told me to stop because it was over my head.
As far as family goes, one thing we always did was we had dinner at a certain time every night. We all sat down at the table and had dinner together. I can't say that there was a lot of exciting conversation. That was kind of a norm back in those days. Work was over at 5 or 6 o'clock and Dad walked home or drove home. And, you know, we had dinner at the table every night.
And if we were really good and if there was a movie we were really interested in, sometimes Dad would turn the TV.
Yep, not very often, but once.
Not very often, but that was a special thing. Turn the TV our way so we could continue to watch. We weren't allowed to stare.
Yeah. I think he let us watch King Kong one year.
And the Tarzan movies, because Dad liked Tarzan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had those little tiny books that were about this big and that thick.
The big little books.
Yeah. Tarzan books.
So Trot's store, the little.
Yes.
What's there now, Brent?
Beisley's restaurant.
Okay, that used to be a little, like, kind of 5 and 10 cent store with Mr. Trot lived in an apartment up above. And to give you an idea, we used to be able to walk up to that, you know, how much freedom we had in town. So I walk up to that and get stuff out of the store. So.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mom used to send me on my bike. I had a basket on the front of my bike. She'd send me up there to get milk and come back. And I'd buy baseball cards. For a couple of years, I was collecting baseball cards, and I just couldn't wait to go up there and get the new.
I wanted to live there. I wanted to live in that apartment above this, because you could just go down and get baseball cards and candy. And I actually knew Lynn Trott. She was in my class, basically, and she did live there.
You were very jealous of her, obviously.
I was jealous of Lynn Trott. Yeah.
And in comparison with what you had today, what you have today, that was about the only thing commercially. I mean, there was nothing that I remember that was further. Which direction is that? Is that west?
That would have been east, southeast of where we were.
There was nothing east commercially of Trot's, where you look at all that stuff that you have out there now, out towards Apple Grove and things like that.
There wasn't really any
commercial thing.
When did Maxie's get built?
What?
Oh, Maxie's was Stewart's Root Beer Stand before it was Maxie's.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a while.
That was not there when I was in high school.
Really?
Well, wasn't it down in the south part of town and they moved it up to the north?
Wow, yeah.
It was down in the south part and they moved it up onto the corner of 7th Street up there. Yeah.
I think the first place like that was, I remember in 1955, 56, when they opened that McDonald's on Cleveland Avenue.
Yeah.
And that was the first McDonald's in the area. And then by the time I was in high school, it was kind of a, you know, you drove in when you were junior and senior, you were driving. That's where you hung out. You drove around, looked for girls and things like that.
I remember the Park Theater and Bill's Diner next door, and there was an alley in between that you always felt the hoods hung out in. They were smoke back there. And it was scary.
The Park Theater was a center for me. It's Saturday afternoon matinees. Cartoon carnivals where you would go and spend 4 hours staring at a succession of 7-minute cartoons for 4 hours.
Yeah, I remember two movies for a quarter, plus a newsreel and a comic to go with it on a Saturday afternoon. And I remember one time that John Hoffman and I went up there and we stayed. We didn't go after the movie. They didn't throw you out for some reason after you watched the movie once back in those days. And we stayed and we were running all over the theater and disturbing people while the second iteration of what we had already seen was running through. And John Hoffman's dad came in and practically dragged both of us out by the ear. He said to me, your parents, you're coming home to John, and your parents want to know where the heck you are too, and dragged us both out of there.
I remember seeing, well, I went there a lot too, and I'd gone for triple features, and there was one that was, for me, it was mostly seeing like really bad science fiction films from that would appear on Mystery Science 3,000 years later. I remember one that was a triple feature. The one was like the giant spider. One was a giant praying mantis. And there was something else giant was the third one. I think an insect, all of course affected by radiation and grown to these enormous sizes. And they were like, so that's like 6 hours or something of sitting through these three really bad science, which I thought were actually really good. But yeah, sitting there all afternoon and eating popcorn and
red vines.
You could get there, yeah. Black cows, remember those? Those things kind of
things you would
yeah. I also remember
sugar. We were the sugar generation.
Yeah.
I don't know how it is that we're not diabetic at this point.
When I was in middle school over there, I used to take the 50 cents that my parents would give me for a hot lunch over at the school, and I'd take it up to Schaefer Drugs and buy a soda, and that's what I had for lunch.
I would actually take my lunch money, and I would go to Laverne's Bakery and buy two cream sticks.
Oh, yeah.
Walk down Main Street, and I'd finish them in the bag, so I'd finish them by the time I got to Trot's. And I would throw the bag in at Trot's and then go quite a few times. And then I kind of got to the point where I didn't want any more cream sticks. But yeah.
Mike Howard and I used to.
Wouldn't one taste good right now? I mean,
Mike Howard and I used to compare milkshakes. We would go into Schaefer Meserly and get a milkshake. And then we'd go over to King's. Remember King's Diner there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Milkshake there. And then we'd go, maybe we have to go back to Schaefer Meserly and try there. We would sometimes drink three milkshakes in a row.
So. Yeah, and everybody remembers Bill's Diner, especially from the Hoover Company days. If you were on the late shift, wasn't Bill's Diner opened all the time? Because I can kind of remember going in there at 12 o'clock at night before you went on for the late shift at the Hoover Company.
Where was it, Bill's Diner?
By the laundromat, I think.
Yeah, it was
the Park Theater, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There was the 5 and 10 beside Park Theater. You had the laundromat, then Park Theater, then 5 and 10, then the alley, then Bill's Diner.
Right.
And on the other side of it used to be that hardware that burnt down.
Yeah. But the diner was one of those old metal shell diners. I mean, it looked like an old style diner, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That section there, that 3 or 4 blocks was the commercial strip in North Canton at that point in time. There was Max Pharmacy that was a little further out, but there was most of the action other than Trout Store and Max Pharmacy was right there in that 3-block strip. That was the core of North Canton at that point.
Main Street and it was the main intersection. What is now Bitzer Park and the Guard House? Remember the Guard House?
It's still there. They just moved it now.
Oh, really?
Well, the Heritage Society bought it and they moved it across the street over like next to the bank and City Hall.
I remember being a patrol boy at the town square with my little yellow belt and
I remember that.
And sending us out there in freezing temperatures.
Well, and of course, back then you had the five streets coming up into the square.
Right.
Came up into the square, which is why the now Huntington Bank is the way it is, built the way it is, because it had two streets coming up on the sides.
Was there still a guard in that guardhouse at that point in time that had something to do with the operation of the light? Or
I think initially they did, but I think afterward it was just kind of, maybe he would come out and help people cross or something like that.
The YWCA building and the YWCA pool, which used to be over by the Hoover Company parking lot, were a core part of life from middle school on up through high school. I mean, that's a lot of the, I used to go up there and play basketball every night in the wintertime when I was between my sophomore and senior year up at the Y, and in the summertime, you'd be up at the pool all the time.
It was actually YMCA, wasn't it?
Not YMCA, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they had the really neat basketball court in there that had the balconies up around.
Yes.
And we all played. I mean, I don't know if you did, Blair, because you were 8 years old, but I don't remember much about you. But the rest of us all played church basketball, right? You did too, didn't you?
Badly.
Well, I didn't say you played it well, but we played for Zion Lutheran Church because they had been right. Basketball leagues up there.
So. Yeah.
I remember they used to hold summer dances in there too.
Mm-hmm.
On that floor when we were in like junior high, early high school. And they also had, remember the public pool? They had dances sometimes during the summer over at the pool too.
Yeah.
I took dance lessons when I was in the sixth or seventh grade in right there. And where I remember that stage with the big curtains up there in the basketball court. It was some sort of, you know, one of those foxtrot type dance classes.
Yeah, Mom made me take those classes, but they were held above Schaefer Messerly. They were upstairs in a dance studio up there.
Well, in the YMCA building, I remember they had a little candy counter in there though too, because after basketball we would stop and buy candy there too. And they had a little like two-lane bowling alley or something down.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Sugar seems to be a theme running through this.
Yeah.
They had that great old red Coke machine that you would put a coin in and shove this handle down, and those little 8-ounce bottles would come out.
Mm-hmm.
Trips to the dentist in those days for fillings were quite quite irregular.
Honestly, they used to feed us, you know, Frosted Flakes, and then we would put 2 teaspoons full of sugar on.
I think Mom put sugar on vegetables. She liked everything that was sweet. She didn't like anything that wasn't sweet. So I think she put sugar on broccoli.
It's astonishing.
I used to put so much sugar on oatmeal that I could taste the granules as I ate it. You know, it's like crunching in my teeth.
Yeah. And just to bring it around, I mean, the candy would sit in the Christmas candy. These wrapped candies would sit in these big shopping bags full down in the fruit cellar, down in the root cellar underneath the steps. And you would just grab them by the handful when you were going out to deliver papers and then ration them out to yourself until you get back to the sack.
Which is what you got you through delivering the papers.
Well, remember, Mom also made those candy wreaths that she would hang on the railings on the stairs, and you would have little scissors there, and you'd cut them off, and you were only supposed to, I think, cut one off, you know, I don't know, at a time or something. I think those wreaths didn't last real long.
No, they looked pretty nasty by the end of the season.
I mean, it was right at the stairs where we were going up to bed.
A little sugar fix right before you go to sleep.
Well, probably the only thing I'll mention that we haven't really mentioned that was part of North Canton was also the drive-in theater.
Yeah.
When we were younger, we would just, before we actually start driving there and stuff, but we would actually, you could walk up, was that Pierce? An extension of Pierce? But anyway, dead ended up by the drive-in theater so you could, where the fence was, so you could go up there and you could actually see the screen right there. And by that time, there was a Lawson's that had been built on out on Main Street. And so we, a few of us would go up there and we would buy big bags of popcorn and can of pop. And by the way, Lawson's had chocolate Cokes and cherry Cokes long before anybody else did in cans. But anyway.
And chip chopped ham.
What's that?
Chip chopped ham.
And chip chopped ham, yeah. But we would buy our popcorn and pop and we'd go sit down outside this guy's house where he had some bushes and hop over the fence and turn up some of the speakers and we'd sit there and watch drive-in movies.
Yeah, we did that too. And then they would catch us and they'd come turn the speakers down. We'd run back in the woods. And then as soon as they were gone, we'd run.
Yeah.
Turn the
speakers up
again. Where was the drive-in?
There's apartments there now. Well, where Mama Guzzardi's is.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, that was, and Marianne Donuts used to be right beside or part of that. That's where the Lawson's was. And basically, it was in that whole property back behind Papa John's and all that, where all those apartments were built. That's where.
I used to sit out on the garage roof, you know, punch the screen out of the window up there and sit out on the garage roof and try to see the movie through the trees.
And how did that work out?
That didn't work out at all. It was like, guess the movie.
Special thanks to Blair, Bruce, Brian, and my dad, Brent. This was a lot of fun. Now, coming in January, we're kicking off a brand new project here at A Place in Time. A special mini-series that will give you an overview of North Canton history, highlighting important dates, key figures, and milestone events. Stay tuned for the history of North Canton. Thank you for joining us this year. I can say with some confidence it's been a weird one for all of us. Hang in there, stay safe, and stay healthy. And never forget we're in this together. We are a community, after all. From all of us here at the North Canton Heritage Society, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a very Happy New Year. A Place in Time is the official podcast of the North Canton Heritage Society. It was hosted and produced by Kevin H. Woodside. The views, opinions, statements made by the host, co-host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily represent those of the North Canton Heritage Society. The North Canton Heritage Society is a member-driven, non-profit historical organization that depends on your membership for support. Please consider becoming a member today by visiting our website, northcantonheritage.org, or our social media pages at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Music and sound effects were provided by the royalty-free websites freesound.org and Free Music Archive. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you around town. Okay.
Are you going to be editing this and everything, or are you?
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, you don't want this part.
I mean, this would be a nice like blooper at the end.
Sure.
Yeah, with us yelling at each other.
No commentary from the peanut gallery. Oh,